Oh, you know, that didn't happen. I made that up. Oh, okay. And what about the black people and the Chinese tattoos? How many black people you know that got a Chinese tattoo? Nah, I wasn't saying like that. I was saying like, you know how black people be getting them and they don't know what they say? Oh, so you made that up too. Yeah, it was just like a funny thing. Now after all that stuff, what do I walk away saying about you? You're not cross-eyed. You're not the voice of a dirty sock. You don't have a Chinese tattoo. I mean, I could go on and on, Kevin. My question is, who's performing? It's me. They're jokes. They're just jokes I made up out of my head, so they show the way that my mind works. Oh, so you're the crazy comic. You're the comic who's got another world going on in his head. Okay, I get it now. I understood his point. Even though I changed my name and tightened my set and started writing from my own perspective, I was making up jokes instead of sharing personal experiences. On the way home that night, I went through my set with Keith, and he demolished just about everything. It was my own private hat court. It turned out I only had one bit that was actually about me. It was a joke I told the thugs from the Richard Island Projects. I just want to let you guys know that I'm not a fighter. I'm a bitch, okay? I don't want nobody coming to me after the show talking about who's the funny one now. Keith approved of that joke. That's the only thing that you have that's personal. Start there and build off of that. What else? Why are you a bitch? What happened? I don't know. That's a good question. Well, here's what you got to do, dummy. Go home and think about an answer. Look at what's actually happening in your life so you can talk about it on stage. Well, there's nothing happening. I just travel back and forth to New York all the time. Man, you really are a big dummy. The answer is staring you right in the face. Chapter 50. You can skip this one. God damn it. I'm running out of titles again. The next part of this story is hard to write, because I did have things happening in my life. I just didn't know how to talk about them. Around this time, Tori and I moved in together. With the money I was making in Sweet Cheeks, we were able to rent a house on 2nd Street in Philadelphia. In the filing cabinet of my life, I would put the decision in the thick folder labeled "seemed like a good idea at the time." It was my first real relationship, and I was too young, dumb, and horny to take care of her emotional needs. Communicate honestly, and repair the damage from the mistakes that I had already accumulated. Those mistakes came mostly from times when we argued so intensely that we broke up and messed around with other people. Sometimes for sex, other times for retaliation. When we inevitably got back together, the knowledge, or sometimes just the suspicion, that one of us had been with someone else made the next fight that much worse. These fights usually took place under the influence of alcohol. When drinking used to be a way to have fun together on my off night, it soon became a match that was continually lighting our short fuses. Once, during a period where Tori moved back in with her parents, I asked someone else at the house. Suddenly, I heard the sound of glass breaking outside. Ran into the street to find Tori kicking another woman's car in. By the time she finished, the fender was hanging off the front, the headlight was broke, and the hood was dented. Tori and I didn't talk for a while after that. Lust and habit eventually brought us back together. And before long, we were fighting about why we left in the first place. We couldn't live with each other, and we couldn't live without each other. We were in a relationship limbo, caught between hope and hurt. One night, while drinking, we got into an argument about a guy she had seen during our most recent split. Then she flipped it on me and got upset about the woman whose car she wrecked. The fight continued all the way back to the house, each word a weapon aimed at a specific wound. The more I slashed, the harder she slashed, breaking skin and cutting deep. Fuck you and your comedy. You're not even funny. Are you listening to yourself right now? You fell in love with me because you thought I was funny. Your head is so far up your ass that only shit comes out of your mouth anymore. I don't even know why I stay with you. You're not going to be successful. Everyone knows it, but you're dumb broke ass. What soon followed was one of the lowest points I ever hit, and it fills me with an amount of shame beyond words. When we are triggered at the place where our deepest wounds lie, we respond with what we know. And what I knew was what I'd seen my parents do when they were fighting. At one point, Tori spit on me. I let loose a volley of curses at her, and she lunged at me. Next thing I knew, I looked up. I had scratches all over my neck and head, and she had a red swelling mark on her face. The next day, we didn't talk to each other. I was so mad at myself for what I'd done. Eventually, one of us crawled back to the other to apologize. We'd have incredible sex, and then we acted as if everything was fine. Another night, I passed out at home after a fight and woke up with the police handcuffing me. I was so drunk I couldn't remember what happened. I didn't have any marks on me, and neither did Tori. As best as I can tell, we got in a screaming match and she decided to call the police because she thought it would hurt more than physical violence. While I was sitting in jail, I realized that she was going to start doing this all the time, but there was a way to stop it. The next time we fought and she laid hands on me, I could just as easily call the cops on her and she'd get taken away. So the next time shit went down, she slapped me across the face. Oh, you going to jail for that? That's what I yelled as I ran for the phone. You going to jail this time? I dialed 911. As soon as the cops arrived, I told them what happened, said she hit me. I said that, and I was glaring at Tori at the same time. They looked at me like I was an idiot. So where'd she lay her hands on you at, sir? That's what one of them asked me. She slapped me across the face right here. Go ahead, take her away. Is there any blood or bruising, sir? No. I called y'all as soon as it happened, so y'all can get up here and just get her out of here. I'm sorry, sir, but there are no scratches, no wounds, no marks. There's nothing we can do here. He turned to Tori. Ma'am, are you okay? Well, officer, she began. No, it's not about her. It's about me, guys. She said, well, officer, she was about to talk. I cut her off. No, it's not about her. It's about me. I'm the one who called y'all. Sir, please. Wait, man, what do you mean, please? This isn't fair. Y'all took me away last time and she didn't have no marks. If I ever had a chance of getting help or understanding from them, it was gone after that comment. They were ready to take me away again. From then on, threatening to call the police and sometimes actually calling them became a regular feature of our arguments. One day I told Keith that I wasn't going to make it to City Line Avenue because Tori and I were fighting. At this point, he knew how committed I was, so he offered to pick me up and get me out of there before it escalated into another police incident. For all his tough love and shit talk, Keith has a great big heart and was a true father figure to me during this time. To this day, I continue to ask him for advice about everything. In many ways, I owe my career to him beyond just the guidance and opportunities he gave me. If it hadn't been for him taking me to New York almost every day, I might have been in prison. Recently, I learned that those rides to New York were just as powerful for him. His mom was sick, and calling me dummy for a few hours each day helped him survive that time. A good mentor learns as much from teaching as the apprentice does from learning. Despite all the drama, Tori and I couldn't seem to break up for good, because our ups were just as strong as our downs. In those times, we supported each other, laughed a lot, fucked a lot. The one thing the good and the bad times had in common was that they were passionate. We thought that sex and passion were the same as love and intimacy. Our friends felt differently. To them, we were that couple. One night, I stopped by Naeem's place and asked if him and his girlfriend wanted to go on a double date to Red Lobster. Naeem said yes, and then had a conversation with his girlfriend in the other room, and the conversation went like this. Naeem's girlfriend said, why'd you say yes? You know what happened last time. Yeah, I just felt bad when he asked if we were avoiding him. Well, we are. Why would you feel bad about that? I mean, one of them always says something, then the other one says some shit back, and then they end up ruining everyone's night. So why don't we just go ahead and buckle up right now? Well, at least they make our worst times look like a honeymoon in comparison. For the first time in my life, I was on a receiving end of other people's hi's, what's, and okays. I wasn't observing a crazy world anymore. I was the crazy one. I never thought I'd find myself in that position. Chapter 51, The Day I Became a Comedian. So you're telling me that I should talk about what's going on with Tori? You're damn right. Keith and I were on our way to New York again. Every time we're in the car, you're telling me about all this shit that you're going through with her and you're getting mad because I'm laughing at your dumb ass. But it is funny. Problems are funny, Kevin. You think you're the only one in the world that's going through relationship problems, dummy? How many guys will breathe a sigh of relief if they can look at their woman during your set and say, see, we ain't the only ones who get like that. There's other couples that's crazy, too. The problems in my relationship felt like something I should be hiding, not talking about. But the truth was, Tori was one of the only things that I was qualified to talk about. Besides sneakers, people call this the elusive obvious. It's right there in front of your face, so close that everyone can see it but you. Talk about shit that people can relate to. That's what Keith kept saying. You don't have to make it up. Your life is funny, stupid. You're making up a story about being robbed by a midget when you don't have to make up a story about calling the cops on your girlfriend because your girlfriend scares you. How many times do I have to tell you to talk about your real life before you get it? Use real names, real conversations, real feelings. Tell them what Tori looks like, what she said, what you said, what you felt. It's so easy that it's hard. I listen in silence. I didn't have a rebuttal. I could see his genius. Finally, after so long, I truly understood what Keith had been saying since the day we met. and what I've been moving toward in small, reluctant steps. After that conversation, I started thinking differently about performing differently. The next day, while Tori was at work, I sat at home talking out loud about our fights and police coming to our house. I was terrified to share this part of my life in public, afraid that I'd be judged harshly by the woman in the audience. This was stuff that I didn't even want my mom to know. Most of all, I was nervous about the scariest piece of advice that Keith had given me. Use real names. I ran through the stories of our arguments over and over. They weren't jokes. They were the shittiest parts of my life. But they passed the Keith test. Is this person real? Yep, she's my girlfriend. Did this story really happen? Happened yesterday. Did police come? Sure did. I'll never forget it. There was no question that Keith could ask that would receive the answer. I made it up. For the first time, I was truly going to be me on stage talking about my life, not a life made up. That night, my heart was pounding through my shirt as I told a room full of strangers about fighting with Tori, and the evening I called the cops. To my relief, the audience cracked up through the whole painful mess. It wasn't the loudest laughter I ever received, but it was deep, rich belly laughter, just on its own. The situation was as preposterous as the joke about the midget robber, but it was real and it was true. So it had an integrity and believability that the other story didn't. I understood then what Keith had meant about the audience needing to know who I was. All along, I've been trying to write jokes. This was another level. I was finding pain points and transforming them into something that could touch and maybe help other people. An entertainer makes you laugh, I realized, but an artist makes you understand. The butterflies in my stomach settled as I painted a picture of me standing in the house, blubbering to the police. I just want y'all to take her as far away as possible. On the surface, it wasn't a funny line at all. It was just a comic exaggeration of something I'd said. But the look on my face and the image of me begging the police to save me from my girlfriend were all the audience needed to laugh. I didn't need to be clever. That night led to perhaps the biggest epiphany of my career. The audience wasn't laughing at the jokes. There weren't really any punchlines. The situation itself might have been funny, since it was a role reversal, but it wasn't that funny. What they were laughing at was my reactions. The humor was in my uniqueness, my personality. Not the way I saw life, but the way I did life. That was the payoff. That's where I struck gold. For the first time, I could see it wasn't my jokes or my delivery or my ideas that were funny. I was actually funny. Chapter 52. Snap Your Fingers Famous. After that breakthrough night, I started to observe my life and what was going on around me in a way that I hadn't before. I started looking not externally, but internally. Over time, my step became more about the situations I found myself in and my responses to them. The smallest thing could turn into a hilarious story if I noticed that my response to it was way out of proportion. That's when I started to get consistent headlining slots in New York. Being myself was actually paying off. The money started rolling in. $400, sometimes $500 a week. I began not just paying my rent on time, but saving money so I could pay off the overdue bills that had gone to collection agencies. Things were finally turning around. After a headlining set at Caroline's one night, I was downing a Kettle One and tonic at the bar. A couple guys approached me and said, Hey man, Dame Dash wants to say what up to you. I scanned the back tables and to my surprise, I saw Dame Dash, who founded Rockefeller Records with Jay-Z. Hey man. I think you funny as hell, he told me. He said, yo, you made me laugh. I think I got a movie for you. A movie? Wait, you want me to act? What, is it like a bit part as a stand-up comic or a real role? Do I need to check with my manager? Why me? These are some of the 100 questions that went through my mind in that moment. But I only spoke one word. Okay. He said, you got a number or something we can meet? Yep, gave him my number. The next afternoon, my phone rang. Can you meet Dame in New York? Sure, when? Tomorrow, 2 p.m. at our offices. I caught an early bus to New York the next day and went to the Rockefeller office. There were framed multi-platinum album awards all over the walls. Everybody was dressed in Rockaware. They were all talking excitedly about the new albums, artists, and deals. Jay-Z walked through the front door and right past me. This was a level of success I hadn't seen before, even on a Def Comedy Jam tour. I made mental notes of what it looked like so I could strive to reach that level too. One day, when I succeeded in comedy, maybe I could have an office buzzing with employees and awards and people making deals. A receptionist brought me into Dame Dash's office, where he sat in a brown leather armchair wearing a white t-shirt and sleeves down to his elbows. He got right to the point. "We got a funny idea for a movie, man. I want you to do it. I think you'd be funny as a star." "Huh? Wait, he wanted me to star? You want me to be the star?" "It's just one thing. Y'all gotta write the movie first." "What? You wanted me to be the star and write the movie? After seeing me perform just once? Capone, Smokey, Charlie Murphy, yeah, they'll all be writing with you." "Okay." It was a crazy conversation. I mean, he was talking to me like I was already on board and best friends with everyone involved. I didn't ask about a contract or how much I was getting paid. Even if it was going to exploit me, it would be worth it for the experience. He put me in touch with the other comedians he mentioned. Capone Lee, Smokey Suarez, Charlie Murphy, as well as a staffer from Rockefeller who would oversee the process. We started going to Charlie's house 2 days a week to work on the script, which was about a good kid on parole trying to make ends meet by robbing houses. I came to love Charlie to death, except for four things. He lived in New Jersey. His house was 2 miles away from the bus stop. He had a car. He refused to pick us up. So twice a week, Smokey and I, we would just take the bus to Jersey, walk 2 miles to Charlie's house, work for 4 to 5 hours, then we'd just walk 2 miles back to catch the bus to Manhattan. It took us less than 2 months to complete the script. When we turned the script in, Dame didn't ask us to change a single thing. He just found a director and started planning the production. Dame was the first real doer I met. He didn't overthink things or try to make them perfect or worry about everything that could go wrong. He just made things happen. The movie, Paper Soldiers, was the first film set that I'd ever been on. With the exception of me, the cast was mostly accomplished people. Beanie Siegel, Memphis Bleek, Michael Rappaport, Stacey Dash, Jay-Z. I mean, when I showed up to work the first day, Dame was there with a director who never really got a chance to direct because Dame kept talking over him. Now, I don't think many people on that crew had much experience making movies. "What do you want me to do?" I asked that as we prepared to shoot the first scene. He said, "Yo, B, just be funny. Just be you." "All right, I can do that." That was the only kind of direction I got all day. "Yeah, man, y'all got some funny shit. Just do it. Just do the funny shit." Dame had no idea to direct, but he was a genius within the lack of knowledge. If I ever did something that he didn't like, he'd say, "Nah, man, that shit ass. Don't do it like that. Do some funny shit, yo." "Was there anything specifically that you didn't like about it, or would you like to see something different? Yo, just do the same shit, but be funny." The dialogue I had walked so many miles to write was barely used. Instead, we improvised all day. Though the process was loose and unstructured, it was amazing to be trusted with the freedom to do whatever I wanted to do and be my best. It would come as a shock later when the director wanted me to follow a script word for word. I never felt like the scenes turned out well. I was new to being around so many high-profile people, so I was careful never to overstay my welcome, even when I was actually being welcome. I remember when Bleek, Memphis Bleek, he's like, "Kev, hey, you want to come out tonight, man? We're going to this club." "I got spots." "Get the fuck out of here with your spots. The fuck is a spot?" "It's a show at a comedy club." "All right, well, have fun. I'm getting laid." Even though I was spending less time in Philadelphia than I ever had, Tori was understanding. Filming a movie made sense to her. That was work. She even drove to New Jersey one day to watch me act, and her support meant a lot to me. 2.5 weeks after we started filming, we were done, and I was back on the New York grind. I nearly forgot about the film until one day Dame called out of the blue and said, "Yo, the DVD is about to drop, man. Be on the lookout for it." He invited me to a screening with the cast and crew, and I was shocked. It was funny. It was moving. It had heart. It was actually good. To this day, I still don't know how it turned out like that. Dame had no filming, producing experience. I had no acting experience. It was never released in theaters. There was no marketing for it. There was no publicity, but it worked. A few weeks later, I was performing and a group of guys came up to me afterwards yelling, "Yo, oh shit, from the B&E gang, you funny as shit, man. Huh? Yo, you funny." They said that and they just moved on. At another club the same night, someone stopped me. "Oh shit, the dude from Paper Soldiers. Damn, what up, man? Hey, you crazy." That was how I learned that the DVD had hit the streets and had become an instant hood classic. As it continued to spread, I became snap your fingers famous. People would see me in the street and start snapping their fingers. "Oh shit, that's my man from, Where you from? I think Dame Dash paid me $175 for the whole thing. But I tell you what, it was worth it. Chapter 53, Squeak, Crunch, Smack. During my year of craft honing, Dave occasionally sent me to the small auditions. Not because he wanted me to get a certain part, but because he wanted me to know what an audition room, casting agents, and the overall process were like. It was a way to get comfortable with something that's an uncomfortable experience for anyone, being judged. I didn't get any of the parts, but I didn't expect to. However, after my third audition, Dave called with an opportunity he felt like I had a good shot at landing. Look, it's very hard to get an audition for Saturday Night Live, but I got you one. I told Lauren Michaels that you were a new, hot young comic on the scene, and he said that's exactly what he wants and asked to see you. What? Wait a minute, Saturday Night Live? Oh my God, this could be game-changing. Life-changing. Holy shit, I'm about to get SNL. That's the first thing I thought. Until Dave added, look, they want you to come in and do three characters. Characters? Yeah, you gotta find three impersonations that you're great at and just do them. You got this. I didn't have shit. Maybe Tommy Too Smooth would have gotten it. But I'd never done a goddamn impersonation in my life. I spent the next 2 weeks thinking about characters I could handle. I eventually settled on one basketball player, Avery Johnson, two actors, Robert De Niro and Denzel Washington. That was the moment that my fate was sealed. First of all, no one in that room, or probably in any audition room, knew who Avery Johnson was. When I did my impression, Dave, I'ma pass you the ball. No one gasped and said, oh shit, that's Avery Johnson. I might as well have been impersonating Tommy Too Smooth. Next, I did my De Niro. I figured I had to do a white guy, and he seemed like the easiest one. So I just squinted and screwed up my face, and I just looked at Lauren Michaels, the gray-haired legend who created Saturday Night Live. And I promptly forgot everything that De Niro has ever said in the movie. As for my Denzel Washington, I extended the pointer fingers on each of my hands as they were guns, waved them in the air and kept yelling, training day, bitch, until I was embarrassed enough to stop. There was total silence in the room, except for the sound of Lauren Michaels eating popcorn and licking the salt off his lips. He seemed more interested in his snack than in me. I went into some of my best stand-up material, but no one even smiled. I just heard the squeak, crunch, smack of Lauren and his popcorn. Sweat started trickling down my back. I wasn't used to performing comedy in total silence. Even when people hated what I was doing, they at least booed or threw chicken. When I was finished, Lauren said, thank you. And I walked out the room. Now, even though the audition didn't feel good, I didn't know what anyone else's had been like. Maybe Lauren was like that with everyone. Maybe my personality was more important than my impersonations. Maybe he saw my potential. Maybe I nailed it. Maybe they saw a young Eddie Murphy or a Tim Meadows in me. Every day after that, all I could think about was SNL. What would happen if I got it? On the comedy circuit, I'd see Tracy Morgan and Chris Rock, who had both started their careers on SNL, and I'd think, oh man, if I get this, I'll be a star. Chapter 54, The Greatest Pilot That No One's Seen. Thanks to Dame Dash's willingness to take a chance on me, one day I found myself sitting in first class on a plane to Los Angeles to meet a young director who just got in the television deal with ABC. His name was Judd Apatow. Judd had told Dave that he was looking for a young black comedian. Now, I might not have been considered for the meeting if I hadn't acquired an edge over other comics at my level of inexperience. Paper soldiers. See, every comedian had footage of them performing at a club, but none of them had footage showing that they could not just act, but hold down a film as the lead. Before I knew it, I was in Los Angeles for the first time. I drove around Hollywood for hours, staring at the palm trees and the mansions, the Hollywood sign and the luxury cars. Then I walked back and forth along Hollywood Boulevard, taking in the stars on the Walk of Fame, the handprints outside Grambling Chinese Theater, the street performers dressed as Marilyn Monroe and Michael Jackson, and thanking God and comedy for getting me this far. When I went to bed that night at the Hyatt on Sunset Boulevard, I couldn't sleep. I just kept thinking, holy shit, I'm in Hollywood. I met Judd in his office the following day and liked him instantly. The audition was the exact opposite of my Saturday Night Live experience. I wasn't a jester being asked to amuse the royalty. Judd was curious, excited, enthusiastic. He explained the idea of the show, which was about three struggling roommates living hand-to-mouth in North Hollywood and hoping to make it big. But the story was less important to him than the characters in it. He asked me what my character would do in different situations, and I would answer. Or more often, I would act it out. And he laughed at everything. Even when it wasn't funny, he seemed to enjoy the process of watching a character come to life. In fact, he enjoyed it so much that I got the part. It paid $25,000, which blew my mind. That was the equivalent of roughly 3 years of shows at Sweet Cheeks. I called my mother. Mom, I did it. I made it. I got a pilot deal. I'm going to Hollywood to do a TV show. I'm so proud of you, son, she replied. I'm happy that you're doing your best. There were probably times when she lost faith in me, but now all of the work and all of the struggle that she put into making me responsible, a respectable person, it appeared to be paying off. At the time, the most famous actor during the pilot was Judge Reinhold, who had starred in Beverly Hills Cop with Eddie Murphy. The rest of the cast I'd never heard of before. A funny little improv comic named Amy Poehler, and a big goofy 21-year-old named Jason Segel. Now, though they're household names now, and they had more experience than I did back then, they were relatively unknown at the time. In the show, Amy paid her portion of her rent by working as a personal assistant to Judge, who played himself in the show. She walked his dog, picked up his dry cleaning, and get moldy food out of the fridge. Jason made his money by dressing up as Frankenstein to greet tourists at Universal Studios. And I was the roommate who got lucky. I landed a popular Bud Light commercial, and I lived off the residuals from that. My character's famous tagline from the ad was, "I love the way it tastes." It wasn't the best line. It was good for me back then, though. In order for me to develop a stronger camaraderie with my co-stars, Judd asked me to live with Jason Segel in real life while we were putting together the pilot. I returned to L.A. with my bags and moved into his house. I wanted to be a good roommate, so on my first mornings there, I cooked him pancakes, but he never woke up in time to eat them. You can't make this type of shit up, people. Almost every day, a friend of his named Seth Rogen came over, and they smoked a shitload of weed in the living room. It was the first time I hung out with productive stoners. They talked about the show, got excited about other projects that they were auditioning for, and they came up with hilarious movie ideas, most of which were still funny when the high wore off. We were often joined by more of their actor friends, January Jones, Charlie Hunnam. Jason Segel's living room turned out to be a better introduction to L.A. than the Walk of Fame. As I studied my lines before the first day of shooting, it struck me as ironic that the guy who hated tests more than anyone in school had ended up with a career that required him to study and memorize things on a regular basis. It was my first time on a Hollywood set with a director who actually gave direction, and the taping came surprisingly easy to me. There were only four things I really needed to do. Know my lines, show up on time, pay attention, be positive. We shot the pilot in 7 days, which flew by quickly. I tried to bring good energy on the set and be easy to work with, because I hoped that this would be my job for a long time. When the pilot wrapped and I left L.A., I gave Jason a check for groceries and rent. He never cashed it. My best guess is that he either lost it while he was high or he smoked it. See, back home, I phoned Dave every day. Hey, Dave, the ABC call yet? No. What'd you think about the show? I mean, what, you think it's gonna get picked up? What about my chances of getting on Saturday Night Live? I mean, like, no, like, you know, I know you don't know, but if you had to put a definition to your feeling, what would it be? Finally, Dave called. He said, "I just heard from ABC." He said, "First of all, Kevin, you're a star." I said, "Oh my God, North Hollywood got picked up?" "No, they passed on it." "Then how am I a star?" "Because it's in you." He said, "Look, you got a special something, and whether something goes or it doesn't go, you'll still be a star." His words felt like something a father might say to encourage a depressed kid. I'd already told my mom, Tori, and my friends back home to get ready to watch me on TV every week. Though maybe there was still a chance that they could watch me on Saturday Night Live. When the $25,000 came in for North Hollywood Pilot, which was more like $12,000 after taxes and commissions, the first thing I did was math. I figured out how much I still owe my mom for the rent that she paid for me when I was starting out, and I gave her a check for that exact amount, but she didn't want to accept it. Since that time, I've seen people work hard to become successful only to have entitled parents exploit them for as much money as they can get. My mom actually was entitled to that money, and I still had to persuade her to take it. My goal in life is to have a heart as big as hers. Unfortunately, I don't. Here's how I know that. Later, I'd find myself in a situation where the thought would occur to me, I damn sure need that money back, don't I? Chapter 55! Look at that energy. Huh? You know why I got this energy, people? Because this book is a good read. Well, for me. Because I'm reading it for you guys, you're listening. So it's a good listen. Huh? How many times have you heard that? So chapter 55. How I became an international superstar in Canada for 1 week, and not actually all of Canada, and not really a superstar, but they did mention me in the papers, so that's got to count for something. Eh? Just as Dave had promised, the year passed quickly, and I was given another opportunity to perform in the New Faces Showcase at the Just for Laughs Comedy Festival in Montreal. At this time, thanks to Keith Robinson, Damon Dash, and Judd Apatow, I was ready. Except for one thing. I had no experience performing outside of the United States. I mean, for all I knew, people were completely different in Canada than here. I told Dave that I wanted to go to Montreal early so I could get some stage time and make sure audience there could identify with my material. Then Dave asked a question that showed me just how unprepared I was. Do you have a passport, Kevin? Huh? A passport. What the fuck is that? Is it a gun? What are you asking me? A passport, Kevin, it's a document that you need to travel to another country. If you don't have a passport, you can't go to Canada, and you can't get back to the United States. Oh my God, I need to buy a plane to go to Canada? It's like, is that like an airline? Like you got United, and you got Passport Airlines? I can't afford a plane. Kevin, it's a document. Well, how the hell do I get one of those? Dave then gave me the address of a government office where I could go get a passport. Standing in line there, I was amazed by what life had become. A day ago, I didn't even know this thing called a passport existed. First of all, it's one of the best-kept secrets in North Philadelphia. Okay, I've never heard anybody discuss a passport. It's not really what you talk about in the hood. I've never been on the street corner and somebody has said, "Hey, man, what the fuck is with them passports?" Nobody's ever said that. Can you believe I didn't get a passport stamp yesterday? No, never hear it. It's never happened. But now I'm getting one so I can go to a foreign country and do comedy internationally. Are you kidding me? In the days leading up to the trip, I barely slept. Sometimes I was excited. Other times I was nervous, especially when I heard that some people in Montreal spoke French. I mean, how are they going to understand my jokes? Traveling out of the country for the first time, going through customs, arriving in a strange city where I knew nobody, getting welcomed with a sign that had my name on it, being taken to a luxury hotel, and getting introduced to all these Just for Laughs people who respected me as a performer. Oh, it was all so incredible that I couldn't stop smiling. I got my feet wet with my first international show, and I was relieved that everyone seemed to understand the material. And I'm not talking wet like the first time I got a little piece of pussy. Because remember, I told you I was cold, so I didn't really know if it was wet or not. This time, my feet got wet. Splash! I jumped in. However, the laughs didn't seem as big as they did at home. A comic named Dean Edwards, who had also auditioned for Saturday Night Live, was in Montreal as well. After one of my warm-up shows, Dean pulled me aside. "Kev, hey man, you're doing great. There's just one thing, you gotta slow down. Make sure everyone can understand you. And you're not just breezing through the material." And I was like, "Dean, I don't know what you're talking about because I don't really talk that fast. I'm out here and I'm just ready to do the set." He's like, "That's what I'm talking about." I said, "I don't know what I'm talking about. I'm just trying to do the set. I'm trying to come in here and make these people laugh and get what I gotta get." "Kev, I don't know what the fuck you just said." That's when I confided in Dean and I told him that I had to take a shit. I've been nervous ever since I landed in Montreal. I told him I think it was the passport. That's been fucked with my stomach. Which theoretically doesn't make sense, but it could have been true. Passports give me gas. Back to the book. He said, "In New York, you know, maybe you can talk that fast, but if you want everyone to relate to you here, you need to at least pause sometimes. That simple pivot was just what I needed. Because there were 24 other comics in the New Faces showcase besides Dean and myself. And each of us, we were all scheduled for two performances. They weren't the biggest shows on the festivals in terms of audience size, but they were the biggest in terms of industry turnout. This is where the heavyweights came to answer the question, who's the next big thing? Oh my God, I obliterated the audience in both showcases so decisively that afterwards the festival's bookers, they added me to every event where they had space. Newspapers were writing about me. Strangers I walked past at parties were buzzing, Kevin Hart, Kevin Hart, Kevin Hart. I felt like the Godzilla of comedy. If Godzilla was 5'4", in black, and wore a size 7.5 sneaker, with a passport. That's what I pictured Godzilla being. What I'm saying is I destroyed Montreal. And then, like in every Godzilla movie, I got destroyed. I was walking through the hotel lobby carrying two newspapers. Both were great reviews of my set. I wanted to save them and show them to my mom. Then I ran into Dean Edwards, who was also on a high from his amazing reviews. Me and Dean went to the bar for a drink, and suddenly his phone rang. Hello? Hold on a sec. Hey, Kev, give me a sec. Real quick. I'll be right back. He stepped away, and I overheard, yo, are you lying, Jason? You lying. Jason, don't tell me that, man. Oh, my God. You got it. Oh! Sounded like Dean was in the back having an orgasm. He hung up. He stood there like he was catching his breath. As he walked back to me, he said, I got it, man. Instantly, I thought the clap, because we've been in Canada for a long time. I didn't know what they were giving out here. Well, I don't know no doctors. That's the first thing I'm thinking in my head. You're going to have to wait this one out till you get back to the U.S., unless you rub your passport on it. I don't know what else passports can do. Somebody has to explain to me the power of a passport. I got SNL. Took me a second to process what he was saying. Then it clicked. Give me a hug, man. It's amazing, dude. I'm happy for you. If he passed the audition, that meant that I'd been rejected, people. Now, one way to know that you're in a society that's not equal is when there's only one slot for a black person in an ensemble cast, or in any group. It's a sign that people are more concerned about looking equal than actually being equal. Granted, Dean could do impressions. I mean, look, he'd done Scottie Pippen and Spike Lee on television before. His De Niro had to be far better than mine. To be honest with you, anybody's De Niro was probably better than mine. A baby, fresh out the womb, screwing up her face and going, meh, has a better De Niro than me. The best man got it. That's what I told him, and I was honest when I said it. Though deep inside me, I could hear the sound of my dreams being smashed to pieces. You the first one who knows. Dean grinned like I ain't called my lady yet. You know, this is crazy. I ordered celebratory shots and held mine up to toast Dean. There's enough spots out here for everybody, goddammit. You got first place today, man. Go out there and show them, man. I'm proud. I'm proud of you. And this shot is to your success. An hour later, Dave called me. Hey, buddy. First of all, before I say anything, I just want to let you know that Dean Edwards got SNL. Did they tell you why I didn't get it, Dave? No. No, they didn't, but it's all right. These things happen, you know? Look, there's a lot more out there besides SNL. Now, I'm fine. I just wanted to get the feedback. It's all good. Dave seemed surprised that I shoulder shrugged it. He said, boy, I don't know how you take this shit the way you do, but I wish everybody had whatever you call this emotion that you got. Just keep doing you, and I'm telling you, Kev, you're going to be all right. SNL was and remains a massive launching pad for comedians, and that door was now closed. It was the second time my dream of becoming a star was dashed, though it wouldn't be the last. But Dave was right. The shoulder shrugging kept it from leaving a bitter taste in my mouth. Besides, I understood their decision. I would have rejected me, too. Even Avery Johnson wouldn't have recognized himself. To this day, I still can't impersonate celebrities. But I do have a passport. Chapter 56. Oh, my God. I'm fucking rich. See, when I returned from Montreal, Dave Becky used the success that I had had there to set up meetings with directors, casting agents, production companies, and television networks. Most of the entertainment industry is in Los Angeles. I mean, look, it's a city full of dreamers hoping for just one of those meetings. So booking appointments with some people was still a challenge. However, Paper Soldiers saved me again. See, between my set from Just for Laughs and a reel from the film, Dave was able to get me in the doors of the biggest executives at the biggest networks. They're talking to you because they're already interested. That's what Dave advised me as we flew to Los Angeles together. You already blew him away on stage and on your tape, so just be yourself. Yeah, but I want to be more than myself. That's what I thought as I sat there. You know, these gatekeepers had probably met with thousands of hopeful kids with stars in their eyes and then forgotten about them as soon as they left the room. So I prepared by essentially putting a set together that they remember. I planned answers to questions that they were going to ask about my background, my goals, my ideas. And I thought of good questions to ask in return. I thought about being funny, likable, vibrant, charming, interesting, positive, exciting, you name it. And I wanted to be it in those rooms. Most importantly, I knew that what I said mattered a lot less than how I said it. It was a job for the fun guy. In office after office, I poured on a personality. Every executive in every room was Miss Davis in my eyes. And I was in a battle to charm them and to let me do what I wanted. These weren't meetings. These were seductions. By the time I landed back in New York, Dave had already gotten calls from the people I met with. Many of them were interested in working with me. My childhood had trained me so well for this moment. So what do you do now? I asked Dave. Well, we wait for them to make an offer. Can we take more than one offer? It was like Christmas for my career. Well, what we want to do is start a bidding war. Let them know there's competition, and then I'll have to show how serious they are. How do they show they're serious? With money. This is how people afforded those big homes and nice cars in Los Angeles. It wasn't from multiple sets of comedy clubs. It was from the Hollywood bidding wars. Oh, man, I was ready to make another $25,000, maybe even $50,000. Woo-hoo. I started thinking about all the things that I could buy with that money. $50,000? Shit. Let this $50,000 come, and it's going to be a goddamn massacre of balling out. You hear me? Passports for everybody. That's where I'm at with it. A few weeks later, Dave called with the news. Hey, Kev, it's confirmed. NBC is going to give you $275,000 for a holding deal. You got to be fucking kidding me! What was a holding deal? What is that? What that means is they have an exclusive right to use you in their programming for a year. You can't work with any other network. So there's no pilot? I don't have to do nothing for the money? No. Oh, my God. I'm fucking rich. Dave, you want some Doritos? You want a cheesesteak? Dave, you got a passport? Right. No, you got one. Because you were there. So you got to have one. I would have bought you a passport. Now, you know what? I probably could have used a good warning next. Because I was 22 and I had no idea about money or how money worked. I just knew that in less than a year, I'd gone from making $175 a deal to more than $250,000. It was more money than I could imagine. Life is amazing. And that's with a capital B. I thought the way to break into Hollywood is to have an acting reel. But you can't put together a good acting reel if you're not in any Hollywood productions. It's a catch-22. And somehow I had gotten around it, thanks to Damon Dash. It was almost as if God was looking out for me saying, all right, man, I'm going to have you do this random low-budget street movie. Now, you may not know why, but trust me, later is going to get your foot in the door. A lot of my philosophy is that life is about making the right choices in the dark. Many people ask me what to do if they have doubts about their career or how talented they are or what their passion is. My answer is, when it comes to the future, it's impossible to have any certainty. I mean, look, I may appear to be certain because I've learned to have confidence in my abilities and faith in my will to succeed. But what I don't know, and what no human being knows, is how we will fulfill our destiny as individuals and what that destiny will be. If you wait for certainty, you will spend your whole life standing still. And if you grow discouraged and give up when things get rough, then you'll miss out on your best possible destiny. So the secret is to be excited about what is in your power to control. Be accepting of what's not in your power to control, and then move with the certainty into an uncertain future. This, of course, leaves open the question of what direction you should move in. The answer, Pay attention, dummy. Life is pulling you there automatically. You don't have to know. You don't have to understand. You just have to trust. There's a flow to life, people. And all you have to do is make the decision to follow that current, even if it seems to be carrying you away from everyone around you. That's why I made my next decision quickly and without a second thought. Even though it was the biggest decision I'd ever made, I decided to move to a place where the current was pushing me. That place was Hollywood. I told her that if she wanted to move with me, I'd get everything set up so we could live together. Though we had such rough times in Philadelphia, I couldn't imagine not being with her. She was my rock. Although at times, a very loud rock. A very aggressive rock. Angry. If a rock could be angry, that's the kind of rock she was. And every now and then, that rock would hit you in the head. But we still loved each other in our crazy way. A relationship is strengthened not by experiencing good times together, but by surviving the bad times. Oh, and trust me, there were plenty of those coming. Life lessons from opportunities. The only way to prepare for what you want is to believe that what you want is coming tomorrow. Or maybe the day after that. If not, then it will come pretty soon. If it hasn't come at like some point, then what I want you to do, you got to change what you want before you waste any more time. I'm talking about you, Tanya. Chapter 57. Remember how I said I was rich in the last chapter? Well, now I wasn't. $250,000 is a lot of money. Until you spend it all. See, we live in a culture where it's so hard to make money, yet it's so easy to spend it. Whoever designed the system is a genius. And I never even saw the money itself. I mean, it was just a big number on a small piece of paper. But that number made it possible for me to sign a rental contract for an apartment in Poinsettia Place in Hollywood and a lease agreement for a two-door Ford Explorer Sport. Then I got a magic plastic card that fit in my pocket with my keys, except it was better than a key because it could unlock every item in every store in the world. It wasn't even really my card. My credit was so bad from all the bills that had gone to collections in Philadelphia, I had to get a card through Tori's mom's account. With that magic plastic, I picked up a watch that was priced expensively, which I now know is different than an expensive watch. And enough throwback jerseys for every day of the month. I furnished my new apartment with the biggest bed, the nicest couch, the most expensive coffee table that I could find, so that I felt like the Godfather every time I walked in the door. Everything was so easy to get. I mean, it felt more like I was stealing than shopping. Of course, the person who was really being robbed was me. Because it didn't feel like I was spending money. I didn't think I was. I mean, if I had a stack of $100 bills in a drawer and no credit, I'd have been able to see that stack rapidly shrinking and know to slow down. Instead, what happened was the stack got smaller, but the magic card kept working. Meanwhile, Tori gave notice at work. I booked a flight for her to make the move. This meant I'd now be supporting two people in Los Angeles. And that was fine with me. I mean, I was going to be the next primetime star. Whenever I drove down Sunset Boulevard, I thought, man, I can't wait till I'm on one of those billboards. Man, boy, I tell you, I can't wait till my face is on the side of that bus. Man, I can't wait until that celebrity tour is stopping outside my apartment saying, that's where Kevin Hart used to live when I was doing all those hit shows to NBC. Oh, my time is coming. As I was setting up my new life in Hollywood, my mom came out to see where I was living and how I was doing. Though my money was already starting to get tight, I made sure to take her to nice lunches and dinners so that she felt like her baby had made it. She gave some wise advice before she left. If you ever hear the words no and can't, you ignore them, Kevin. They don't exist. Don't let them get in the way of the goals that you need to accomplish. It was advice she followed herself. I mean, while working at the university, she was also studying for a master's degree. Mom, why do you even need a master's degree? Like, what are you studying for? She said, everything. See, she loved learning, which is something else she passed on to me. I must have attended 4 different graduation ceremonies to celebrate degrees she earned. Eventually, NBC cast me in a pilot. It was called Class of 06 and was described to me as a younger Friends. With the freshman roommates on the college campus. It also happened to be written by one of the writers of Friends, so of course this was going to be huge. It ended up being as huge as North Hollywood. Let me tell you something. We poured our hearts and our souls into it, and it didn't get picked up. With stand-up comedy, the better I was on stage, the more successful I became. With television, it seemed that talent had nothing to do with success, because a corporation was making the decisions. The criteria were different. The decision was based on numbers. We didn't talk about ratings, measurements, and quarterly earnings at the table. After the pilot failed, NBC didn't bring me any more work. A holding deal, it turned out, is exactly what it sounds like. NBC held me. And I couldn't do anything on television for the rest of the year. While waiting for my freedom, I decided to hit the comedy clubs and work my way toward becoming a multi-set Hollywood Kev. After my first performance at the Comedy Store, I spoke to one of the other comedians trying to figure out where the L.A. equivalent of the Comedy Cellar comedian table was. So what you guys doing afterwards? Going to where the women at. Was there a table where all, like, the comedians hang out after they sets? What are you talking about? What do you mean what I'm talking about? Y'all don't hang out? Discuss material? You can come to Joseph's. What's that? It's a dance club with banging women. Yeah, I heard you when you were saying you was looking for that. But I'm saying, where's the table? Nah, you don't want to pay for no bottle service. What the fuck are you talking about? The table, comedians. See, the comedy scene in L.A. was different than New York. Comedians didn't shuttle through the city doing spots at multiple clubs at night. There were good places to perform, Ha Ha Cafe, The Improv, Laugh Factory, The Comedy Store, a few others. But I was lucky to get a booking a month. After I performed somewhere, even if I killed, it felt like they'd rather see someone new than bring me back. A lot of performers there were bitter. They'd been in Hollywood for 10, 20, even 30 years and had made it. So they had no patience for a young, enthusiastic kid with a holding deal. Rather than trying to elevate the art of comedy, they were trying to elevate their mood with clubbing, drinks, and women. So I adapted and became multi-party Kev. Every night there was a different club, lounge, or mansion that I was going off in. There was always something to do. Anything but work on your craft. During the day, I killed time on the basketball court, at the gym, playing video games with other young comedians I met, like Nick Cannon, Rodney Perry, a guy named Harry Ratchford, who soon became one of my closest friends. Since the bowl cut years, one of the most important things to me has always been a good haircut. But every place I tried to go in Hollywood was an overpriced beauty salon where some hairdresser to the stars fucked my shit up. Finally, one night at Joseph's, I was bitching about it to some guy. He said, yo, you can't get your haircut in Hollywood, man. Might as well get your haircut in the mall. You gotta go down to Inglewood. I got a goddamn place for you there. He sent me to the hood. A hood barbershop called Platinum Cuts on Manchester and La Brea. He didn't give me anyone's name, so I just parked my Explorer and walked inside to check it out. The first rule of barbershops is never go to the motherfucker in the first chair. I don't care where you go. That guy, he's always the hustler. He's hitting up people first when they come in. Yo, 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 what you need? I got you. Come here, sit right here. The guy in the second chair is better. He's competent, and he has some regular clients. But whoever's in the last chair, that means that guy, he's confident in his skills and the demand for him. Oh, I went straight to the last chair. The dude standing there looked like Ice-T if Ice-T worked a 9-to-5 job, never exercised, and smoked so much weed that he could barely keep his eyes open. He was with a client and talking about how Busta Rhymes was one of the greatest lyricists of all time. Hey, man, how many you got? That's what I asked him. He said three people were in front of me, so I waited. I knew it would be worth my time. When my turn came, I hopped into the chair and introduced myself. He said his name was John, but people called him Bird. When he finished, I looked in the mirror, and just like when Greg cut my hair in the middle of school, I felt like a new and better person. Hey, man, can you be my barber? I just got out here. I'm a comedian. I don't know where else to go. He said, yeah, I know you. I saw you at the Improv a few weeks ago. Somebody was heckling, and you said, man, shut your ass up with your teeth over there looking like baby shoes. He was right. They look just like baby shoes. That's what I thought. It's like, yo, this motherfucker here funny as shit, man. That was the last time I received a compliment at Platinum Cuts. As people grew to know me there, I'd walk in and they'd go, oh, you think you're a comedian? What's funny about you, nigga? You just look funny. Man, get the fuck out of here with your lopsided head. That's what I'd snap back. Look like a stop sign that someone hit with a baseball bat. Finally, I found a place in Los Angeles that was just like the Comedy Cellar table, where I could go and I could keep my skin thick and my wit sharp. Platinum Cuts became my church. I spent every Sunday there, trash talking and learning about the world. To keep my New York edge, I began letting my friends from the Comedy Cellar crash at my place when they were in town performing or auditioning. One day when Patrice O'Neill was staying with me, I came home from the barber shop and called out, "Patrice!" It was silence. I went to my bedroom, put on my slippers, sat on the edge of the bed. It was the middle of the afternoon. I just wanted to hang with Patrice. I mean, maybe he was somewhere in here. I went to the back room, opened the door. I saw that big motherfucker slumped in the chair, intently focused on something. "Hey, man, what you doing?" He jumped out the chair. "Shut the door, shut the door." I said, "What the fuck is going on here? Shut the door, man, so I can clean myself up." I noticed that his pants were open and that there was a bottle of baby oil on the desk. "Oh, no. Oh, shit, Patrice. No, man, my bad. God damn." I backed out, closed the door. 15 minutes went by before he emerged from the room. Patrice looked at me and said, "Hey, man, look, there's nothing to say." I said, "Well, I got something to say. I think I'm permanently scarred." "I'm sorry. No, I didn't know that nobody was back." "Okay, man. Just don't say shit about this, Kev." "Look," I said, "you're my friend. So, of course, I have to honor that friendship and never let you forget the moment that we just shared. Come on, Kev. Don't. No. I'm gonna put this shit in my set, Patrice. Okay? This is the moment. I'm not a set. The set won't do it justice. I'm gonna put it in the movie. I'm gonna put it in my book. That's what I'm gonna do. You just wait and see." So RIP, Patrice. I love you dearly, but I kept my promise, brother. Our moment is in my book. See, he decided not to wait and see. But when you love a guy with all your heart, this is why you never let him forget it or other great moments that we've shared. He's somewhere in heaven right now, jerking off. I promise you. Patrice, don't jerk off in heaven. Patrice, don't jerk off in heaven, Patrice. Chapter 58. If I think I'm too good for you, but you reject me, then who's too good for who now? Think about it. As the expiration date of my holding deal approached, I felt like a racehorse ready to charge through a starting gate. What I discovered, however, was that on the other side of the holding deal was something called waiting for another deal. The auditions I went on when my holding deal ended were different than the meetings I had after Just for Laughs. See, in a meeting, they were interested in who I was. In an audition, they usually weren't. It was a cattle call for actors. I mean, one of my first big auditions was so bad that the casting director took the script out of my hand and she said, "Okay, that's enough, sir. Well, would you like me to try to do it another way?" "Nope, we don't want you to do it any other ways. That's enough for us." The word no, or sometimes the more polite two-word rejection, "thank you," they became as much a part of my life in L.A. as traffic jams and parking tickets. "Kev, what happened to you in that audition you went on?" "Didn't get it." "What about that pilot?" "Didn't get picked up." "How about the..." "Nope, don't even ask." A new routine settled over my life. It consisted of going to open casting calls and not getting the part. More auditions, still no part. Finally getting the part, shooting the pilot, waiting for the pilot to get picked up. The pilot doesn't get picked up, more open calls, more auditions, more testings, more pilots. Nothing happens. "Hey, there's a call for extras. I'm desperate. Why not? Show up, hope it turns into a speaking role." It doesn't. "Maybe I'm not good enough actor." Get an acting coach. Start to cycle from the top. One of the reasons I was able to survive all the rejection was because it was so familiar from my childhood. Can I play with my friends? No. Can I go to the movies? No. Can I check out that party for just a few minutes? Hell no. Every experience is a potential life lesson, even if you don't appreciate it at the time. Each struggle in the present is preparing you for something else in the future. Hollywood is a horrible place for relationships, especially since Tori and I had packed all of our emotional baggage up and brought it with us. Any problem between us was exacerbated by living in a city where we had no family or close friends. The nightlife swallowed us up. It wasn't like going out in Philadelphia. Everything in Hollywood had shine on it. It was full of the most beautiful women, the most expensive cars, hottest clubs, classiest restaurants, and the endless parade of celebrities and wannabe celebrities. Now, most of these people could barely afford to be in these places. Just about anywhere else in the world, what they were doing would have been called partying. But in Hollywood, it was called work. People justified spending all their time and money and going out, drinking, drugging, and fucking because it was networking. One day they might wake up with that special someone who would make their career. Though more likely they'd be passed around, used up, and spit out. I was right there with them, throwing my life away. I didn't want to be home. I didn't want to be in a relationship.